Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 328 of the Fun with Cars Motorsport Podcast, or episode 15 of 2022. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man who decided against taking his Miami yacht to Monaco because they actually put them in the water there, Christopher Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Robin.
Do you keep it, like, just dry moored all the time, and then you set up some blue plywood on occasion when you want to use your yacht?
Yeah, it handles really well in plywood fake water. In real water, it seems to struggle. So it's just...
I see.
So I figured I'd keep it in Miami permanently in the parking lot there, you know, for football games later in the year, tennis matches, stuff.
You got that special square hull that just rests on the plywood really well. That's good thinking. No, it's good thinking. It is Wednesday morning, June 1st, and Chris and I are going to talk about the Monaco Grand Prix and the Indianapolis 500. But first, oh, Chris, I imagine you have a touch of Formula One news, because even I do as well.
Well, there is there's some big news. There's some little news. So the big news, of course, is Sergio Perez has signed an extension with Red Bull for 2 years to take him to the end of 2024. And hot on the heels of his Monaco win, is he now in the title race, Robin?
Well, there are rumors to that. No, he's not. He will be brushed aside to the next Grand Prix without a second thought, I'm sure. And it was, I think, you know, he was the quicker Red Bull all weekend, and absolutely deserved the win. And he had good strategy calls, et cetera, et cetera. So he did everything right and deserved that win. Max just seemed to have a slightly off weekend, but we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Darn fine weekend for him. He gets the biggest victory, the Monaco Grand Prix win, and he gets a 2-year extension deal in the same weekend. Yeah, not a bad way to spend your Memorial weekend.
Indeed not. The other tidbit of news I have is a former F1 driver by the name of Kimi Raikkonen is going to be competing at the Watkins Glen round of NASCAR in October. And so he's going to be demonstrating his fine left and right handling skills.
Yeah, it's, you know, he teased NASCAR a little bit in between Formula One. So when he left Ferrari the first time and did some rallying and then tried to touch a NASCAR, that's what he did before he went back to, I think it was Lotus at the time. Mm. And ended up running in Formula One for several more years. So I could, you know, it's a natural progression to me. And for him to start at a road course makes plenty of sense. And to start at a historical F1 track is nice as well. However, NASCAR does not run the big Watkins Glen track. It is kind of chopped up a little bit. So it's a little bit kind of a Mickey Mouse compared to the proper big old school track, but you know, it's still the Glen.
Yeah, that'll be cool to see how he gets on. Obviously, as you mentioned, he raced in the truck series back in the day, which is, I think, the third tier of, in the NASCAR hierarchy.
Yes, exactly. It's trucks and then the Busch series and then Cup. And I don't know if it's called Busch series anymore, but that's what I remember it as.
Yep, so this will be with the big boys, and that'll be entertaining, I'm sure. I suspect he'll either win or shunt.
Well, my Formula One news included Sergio as well, but the other one for me was is not really news. It's more rumors that Daniel Ricciardo is starting to be in genuinely hot water with the McLaren team, and I mean that in the sense that Zach Brown openly, publicly said that Daniel Ricciardo has to step it up, and that basically he's contracted through 2023, but there's ways to get around that.
Yeah, we talked about this in the last pod. The rumors seem to be escalating, don't they? Apparently, the contract is in sort of favors Ricciardo. It's basically he has an option to extend by a year. So it's basically his decision is the way I've read it. But yeah, I'm sure if McLaren really want to replace him, they'll buy him out or find a way to spot that clause that no one else noticed that says, based on poor performance, we can boot you. Yeah, it's sad. I think there's still time to turn it around. I know some people are basically saying it's a done deal, but I think, there's still, what have we got, 15-odd races in 22. So, if you could sneak another win at Monza or somewhere like that and get a little bit closer to Norris's pace, then I'm sure there may be a desire from both sides to extend into next year. But his pace was pretty lamentable over the weekend. He was well off Norris's pace.
And that coincides with the newsy part of this, which is that Pato O'Ward has got a contract extension with McLaren, and that includes F1 testing. So Pato O'Ward has made no secret about his desires to eventually make it to Formula One, and obviously, having McLaren as a team does not hurt those chances. And, the fact that he's young and hungry and showing real pace and Zach Brown likes him, all three things against Mr. Ricciardo.
Who would you rather have in the second McLaren seat, though, between Ricciardo, O'Ward, or maybe Colton Herta? Who would you pick?
Throwing Colton Herta in there at the last moment complicates it, because Colton Herta would be an American in Formula One again, aside from all the other things. So, but if we kind of take it as, should Daniel Ricciardo stay or go, I think he should go, and I think he should go for his sake as well as the team's. It's just, for whatever reason, there's something about the way McLaren operates and or the way the car's set up, it just doesn't work with him. But he's faster than this last year and a half has shown, and it's just not fair that he has to keep saying that or believing in himself that way. There's got to be a team out there that has a better fit.
Yeah, I think it would be a real shame to walk away from the sport entirely. If he can't find a way and McLaren aren't willing to help him solve his current issues and re-find his inherent pace, then maybe a seat at another team would make more sense for him. But certainly, I think the sport is stronger and better off with him in it. As Sebastian Vettel has demonstrated, he's had some pretty tough seasons, obviously, since his last championship win. But he's still capable of the odd strong performance. Monaco was no exception. He did a pretty good effort over the course of the weekend. He's had his ups and downs, but he's persevered and again shows us, what you'd expect of a four-time world champion. I think the same could be said of Daniel.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Monaco, it was interesting. And it was interesting because of the weather that we got throughout the weekend. Lots of warmth and then obviously some moisture. But it was also quite interesting with how the FIA reacted to the weather. And we had, practice and some interesting things happen in qualifying, certainly. But where would you like to start for that weekend? Because I have a lot to say about the race.
Well, I think we've got to touch on qualifying. Charles Leclerc was looking to be in a class of his own, wasn't he, through qualifying?
He just always had a few tenths somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Comfortably got pole position. And prior to Perez crashing and blocking the track with Carlos's help, he was on an even faster lap, which I think was something like 3 or 4 tenths up on his pole setting lap. So it was going to be if he'd managed to complete that, it was going to be a mega time, maybe in the 110s. So it looked like on out and out pace, Charles was way ahead of the rest of the field. To be fair to Carlos, we've been talking about his struggles this season. Carlos did a good, solid effort. Obviously, the Ferrari was quick around the streets of Monaco, and he locked out the front row for Ferrari, which usually means, a race win.
Especially in Monaco, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then we had the unusual sight of a second row filled with Red Bulls, but with the number two driver leading. And you have to say, Sergio's pace was consistently quicker than Max's. Through most of the free practice sessions, most of qualifying, And you'd have to say in the race, Sergio seemed to be able to get slightly more speed out of his Red Bull than did Max, which is, you know, very unusual. There aren't many occasions in recent memory that you can think of that happening. And it looks like
he listened to our last podcast, and
he did indeed.
You know, it motivated him. Well, let's talk about that though a little bit. So Sergio Perez, it was just, he was obviously pushing. He spun the car. A good, I would say, 5-6 seconds passed before Carlos arrived, and, you know, last minute kind of avoidance of Perez is what caused him to spin as well. Certainly, Carlos didn't spin independently. He spun trying to react to Sergio being where he was. But what do you think about him having several seconds to be notified that something was blocking the track? There were yellow flags up and on and on. I mean, where do you fall in terms of that decision making?
Yeah, well, clearly he was fairly focused on his own lap, wasn't he? And maybe didn't pay attention to the flags or any radio transmission. And got caught out easily done, right? I mean, most of those corners are blind. Just because there's a wave of yellow doesn't necessarily mean the track is entirely blocked, you know. And if that's your last shot at getting pole position, you might be tempted to sort of keep your foot in until you really have to lift. So I don't blame Carlos for what he did. I mean, it's a classic Monaco qualifying. I mean, I can't even remember how many sessions have been ruined in the, you know, last moments of Q3 with someone shunting. You know, Rosberg did it, Schumacher did it, you know, countless people have done it. I mean, Charles himself shunted last year in qualifying.
I mean, Schumacher even did it on accident sometimes.
Schumacher, yeah, sometimes intentionally, sometimes, you know.
That was a little Robin joke thrown in there. Okay.
I mean, it does make me laugh, these drivers, including Lewis, I might add, who say, well, you know, I would have been way up the order if I'd managed to get my second Q3 run in. No, just go back to any year prior at Monaco, and you would have known that someone's bound to shunt it, so you've got to get your lap in early. So, don't, you know, that's just a feeble excuse, in my opinion. I don't know why the Mercedes guys went out on worn softs for their first Q3 runs. That made no sense at all to me. So there were some weird things going on, but ultimately, you know, it was an interesting order. It looked like it was going to set up a, you know, relatively straightforward win for the Ferraris, or one of the Ferraris at least. As far as everyone else goes, I mean, we got a whole new way of getting the Mercedes to bounce, not through porpoising, but just through stiff springs and lack of damping and compliance, so the cars just bounce around. I mean, brilliant, guys. Well done. And they weren't particularly quick, the Mercedes, over the course of the weekend.
I've never seen Hamilton's hands moving around so much. And so quick. I mean, that car was clearly unsettled. If you watched him driving the car through a lap, it certainly was a departure from what we're used to seeing of Mercedes, even at a place like Monaco.
Yeah, it wasn't great. I mean, we knew they weren't that quick through the slow section at Barcelona, and that definitely translated into their Monaco performance. Yeah, I mean, you got to talk about Norris, the only driver outside of the top four to get into the 1:11s, over a second quicker than his teammate, and still not fully recovered from his bout of tonsillitis. Really impressive effort from Lando. Seemed very much at home around the streets and you know, exemplary qualifying.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. He's continuing to punch above his weight in that car, because I really don't think the McLaren was quite as quick as Lando made it. Or another way to put it, he really did absolutely extract the maximum out of that car. And to have Daniel Ricciardo, just as you say, that far off of that pace, that was frustrating in its own right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But, so what did you make of, just before we go on to the race, obviously it was a slightly different weekend format, because traditionally Monaco had practice on Thursday, you know, a rest day on Friday. Then they would do qualifying race. Now this year, they'd moved the Thursday practice to Friday. So we had a more traditional weekend. I guess it to me, it lost a little bit. because I always quite like the Thursday sessions and then, you know, an extra day to ruminate on who might be quick or not. And it was always part of the sort of unique nature of Monaco. And I think by standardizing it, it's starting to sort of water down the experience a little bit. And maybe that's one of the things that's leading to Monaco being in jeopardy as a permanent fixture on the F1 calendar.
Yes. I mean, there was kind of a loss of tradition there to a certain extent. I didn't have any strict or hard or big feelings about it one way or the other, to be totally honest. But it does go into, just as you said, there's, you know, Monaco, there has to be some negotiations yet about Monaco returning. And also, this is something we should talk about a little bit more later, but man, the cars have grown so much. You know, it's harder to squeeze these things around that track these days.
Well, some people manage to do it, you know, side by side, a few passes. I mean, if your name's Pierre, you had a good day, didn't you? So it is still possible to pass, even in tricky, wet, dry conditions. You're not going to make the track any wider, are you? There's a lot to think about there in terms of how, what could be done for Monaco specifically to keep it on the calendar and make it a little bit more relevant to today's racing cars.
I mean, there's so much about Monaco that's just unique and exquisite and fantastic, and it is just kind of the perfect summary of what Formula One is. It's risk, it's glamour, it's, you know, style, it's, you know, it's all these things kind of wrapped into one tiny little package. And plus the track itself, you know, no straightaway, the straight definitely has a curve in it. And, you know, you're going through a tunnel, you're going down by the harbor, and all these different aspects that just, you know, it'd be nigh impossible to repeat anywhere else, especially if you're trying to adhere to modern safety standards. So it's kind of a grandfathered in thing that if we lose it, we lose it for good. And that's the end of it.
Yeah. I mean, as frustrating as the race is with the lack of real passing opportunities genuinely amongst the top runners on similar tires, you know, it's still on my bucket list to go and watch those cars race there, because some of the footage of the how close the cars get to the Armco barriers, just incredible. And then Martin Brundle did a nice he does this roving reporting and during free practice where he goes out with a single camera and they just talk about who looks quick through, you know, couple of corners on the track. And, you know, he was standing opposite the casino and he was genuinely nervous at times with some of the cars, you know, taking weird lines through the corners. And, you know, there was, I think, a three-tier Armco, but that wasn't going to stop a car if it really headed his way. So it just looks like the most spectacular place to watch an F1 car, really, just because of how close you can get to them and how much talent you could see with these guys threading the needle through those very tight and twisty streets. So, I would be sad if we lost it, but the race is a struggle, isn't it? I mean, I wasn't sad that we lost 11 laps. You could see that wasn't going to be any overtaking, you know, and just like, unless someone breaks down, pretty much the order's set after the round of pit stops.
Well, and this is a great opportunity to dig into the race because it proves exactly that point. I'm still perplexed as to what the logic was, because it just wasn't panning out and everyone saw that. But Fernando Alonso deliberately slowed down, what was it, 3 seconds a lap, perhaps a little more, just to try to hold up Hamilton to give Ocon a chance to get around him again. But Ocon already had a 5-second penalty and on, and all he was doing was bunching up the field, et cetera, et cetera. But Alonso could do that without much fear of overtaking. He could take 3 seconds a lap off of his time. Normally, what are you trying to say? You need to be half a second quicker, maybe a full second quicker, to be able to make a pass on another Formula One car. Here's a Formula One car intentionally doing 3 times worse than that, and you still can't get around.
Yeah, there's a long history of that, isn't there? I mean, we've had you know, the most memorable race for me was 92 with Mansell on brand new tires trying to pass, right, Senna. And his Williams must have been even, you know, greater performance differential, maybe 4 or 5 seconds quicker. And Senna just knew exactly where to place his McLaren and you know, gave Mansell a choice, either stay back and take your second place or risk crashing. And so Mansell wisely didn't try and make a pass. But yeah, you can undoubtedly block if you're a competent F1 driver and you know what you're doing. And, you know, it was funny how we had Alonso, Hamilton and Vettel all in a line on the grid. The amusing thing for me about what Alonso did was, I think it might have been a coded message to his former team, i.e. Ferrari, in that all they needed to do to win the race was have Carlos run 3 seconds a lap off Charles's pace for the first 20 laps, and they would have canted to the win. Right? I mean, we can talk at length about Ferrari's strategy, but they totally didn't understand how to guarantee one of their drivers win the Grand Prix. And Red Bull showed them how it's done.
So let's talk about that. Ferrari's decision-making throughout the Monaco Grand Prix, it was kooky almost. I was really perplexed by it. And Charles was making his frustrations known on the radio, but boy, you can't help but completely understand where he's coming from, because he's getting decisions, come in, wait, stay out, wait, do this. I mean, there was indecisiveness in the Ferrari pit on top of decisions that just didn't make sense intuitively.
Yeah, so we had the transition from full wets to inters. Gasly was one of the first runners to switch and demonstrated how much quicker that tyre was in the drying track conditions. Everyone on the, you know, down the pit wall has that access to that data. They can all see what Pierre's lap times are. So as soon as one of the front runners, you know, the Red Bulls, pitted, there was always the risk of being undercut if you also decided to switch the inters. And Ferrari, you know, waited 2 laps to bring Charles in, by which point, you know, they should have been able to calculate that he was going to come out behind Sergio and therefore, you know, lose track position. So disastrous decision right there to pit him. They should have kept him out once they realized that the opportunity to pit him and get him out ahead of Sergio had gone. So they didn't. So that was their first mistake. You know, Carlos wisely rejected the switch to inters and said, I'm going to wait until we can go into full dries. You know, based on that initiative, he almost got the win, because I guess if he hadn't been held up by Latifi on his outlap, he might have just snuck ahead of Sergio. But yeah. As Latifi likes to do,
pits, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, as Latifi likes to do, he ruins all the top drivers' races.
Yep, so we already checked Mercedes off the list. Ferrari is next.
Yeah.
So, bizarre calls, absolutely. But do you think the bizarre calls didn't start with Ferrari? The bizarre calls seemed to start with the FIA. We had rain start to come just as the race was getting on the way, cars were getting on track, and then the rain came. And there were these weird delays to the start, and the delays kind of compounded on each other. And it seems like we could have had an on-time start, and there might have been a red flag in the middle, but maybe not. I can't. It's a little bit difficult to say once you're in the race. But anyway, the race was delayed by nearly an hour to start with, and I think that threw a lot of people off.
Yeah, some odd decisions by Freitas, who was the race director this weekend. You know, he was concerned about the lack of wet running previously in the weekend. Well, these had the best, you know, supposedly the 20 best drivers in the world. You know, they don't need to practice their wet weather running. In fact, the race would be more interesting if you don't let them practice it. So exactly. let them crack on with it, and then, you know, delaying the race for anticipated rain. I mean, that's absurd. Just get on with it. So yeah, there's been a lot of criticism for those decisions. And you know, obviously we didn't get a standing start either. I think for the restart after Schumacher's crash, the reason given was that, you know, half the track was dry and half the track was wet. So it would have been a massive disadvantage to those starting on the wet side. So I can kind of understand that. But I don't really like the safety car wet start procedure. I think it's all, it just, especially at a track that's so inherently hard to pass on, it just takes away all that element of uncertainty and opportunism that comes from a standing start. So yeah, a bit of a missed opportunity there by the FIA, I think.
Absolutely. But there was the call, just as you said, to be late with inters, and that certainly handicapped him. But then there was the decision to bring Leclerc in for full dries just behind Carlos Sainz. And not only was it a double stack pit stop, but there was also confusion in the calls. They said, okay, come in. No, wait, stay out. But it was too late. He was already entering the pits. So Ferrari was conceding that it made a mistake before Leclerc had even made it to the box.
Yeah, I guess Carlos's pace on those worn wets was so poor, they were surprised how quickly Charles was able to catch him on that in-lap. And that's what made them change their mind, because they then realized that he would have to wait for Charles to clear the pit box before they could change his tires, and that would drop him behind Max. Yeah, they completely...
Wait for Sainz to clear the pit box, just briefly, just real quick, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. So they completely bungled it. I thought at one point there were some predictions of further rain, wasn't there? So maybe staying on inters might have been the smart move if you had a pretty reliable indication that there would be another shower. But it actually never transpired, that rain shower. So it really was daft. I mean, it was the clear strategy in hindsight was a fairly early move to inters, because they were much, much quicker than the wets after about 15 laps or so. And then, you know, you move over to the dry tires at the appropriate time. And if they just figured out, Christian Horner said after the race, all Ferrari had to do was pit Charles one lap after they pitted Sergio, and they would have won the race.
Yeah.
So they just delayed that decision too long, and it cost them big time.
Yeah, it's exactly right. And, you know, he, small silver lining to this, Charles Leclerc did actually finish the race, which, I mean, it almost seems like it would have been better if he didn't finish the race and he could have just, you know, headed off to his apartment and played the piano a bit. I mean, it was cold comfort that he finished the race and collected some points. It just seemed like just a raft of just one bad decision compounding on another. And just, I think what hurt as much as anything is he had such commanding performances the day before in qualifying, and to see it kind of fall apart on him, that just made it that much more frustrating.
Well, and also, to be fair to him, at the start of the race in the wet, I mean, he pulled out a gap of more than 5 seconds, and it looked like he was in total control. So the only thing that could go wrong was the pit stops, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, yeah, very unfortunate for Charles. He drove brilliantly and thoroughly deserved the win, honestly. And to get fourth, not even on the podium, I mean, that is really, you know, salt into the wound, isn't it? Yeah, feel bad for him. But you have to give Red Bull a lot of credit. I mean, we saw it when they were up against Mercedes. They are such a good race team. You know, they are very smart on their strategies. They are very aggressive. They force other teams to react to what they want to do. More often than not, they get those strategies right. They're willing to roll the dice. They're willing to risk, you know, losing a place to try and get a better result. And it paid off for them. I mean, you know, from 3-4 on the grid to 1-3 finish is... Yeah, brilliant. You've got to give them all the credit in the world. They're probably the best race team in Formula One, I would say, in terms of pit stops, pit strategies, you know, and aggressive overall race planning. They seem to be just that little bit better than everybody else.
Yeah. No, I think Monaco showcased their strength, you have to say, at a minimum. And I think a lot of what you're saying is exactly right. Another shout out, George Russell maintains his top five finishes for the season. Fifth place here in Monaco.
It was close with Norris though, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it was quite close. And he managed to hold on. And again, it's Monaco. And he continues to just meld into that team so smoothly. And just, I think makes it very comfortable for the team to see him as heir apparent when Lewis Hamilton decides to move on.
Yeah, no, I mean, Russell made the best of the Mercedes again and drove well and held Norris off, because Norris did a fairly late pit stop and was absolutely flying late in the race. His fastest lap, which was the fastest of all runners, he got into the 14s. Nobody else was running in the 14s. The top four were all running in the 16s. Their fastest lap were 1 minute 16 plus. So he was absolutely flying. The only one close to him was Fernando Alonso, who got into the 15s. Of course, he'd saved his tyres till late in the race. But, yeah, very impressive. I think Norris was within a second at the end. But, of course, being Monaco, Russell was able to hold him off fairly easily. Good effort by both of them.
Any other finishes, any other results at Monaco that stood out to you?
Well, I think we've got to talk about Ocon. So, obviously, Ocon got the penalty for the clash with Hamilton going into turn one. Ocon basically just closed the door on Lewis, catching his front wing. Got a 5-second penalty for his trouble. Now, if Alonso had just run a normal pace, there's a chance that Ocon could have got far enough ahead that he might have got a top 10 finish. But with Alonso's antics, he was basically forced, you know, back into the clutches of Bottas and Vettel, and so therefore finished outside the points. So a very odd strategy by Alpine there. I just don't really understand, you know, what they were doing. I mean, if Alonso realises he can go 3 seconds a lap slower than his ultimate pace and still hold Hamilton off, why does he think his teammate's going to be able to pass Hamilton? I mean, this doesn't make any
exactly.
sense. They're much better off just getting their head down and running as quickly as they can, so he has a chance to make up that 5 seconds. Really odd thinking.
Well, exactly right. And, you know, just as you said, so Ocon was right behind Hamilton, and yet Hamilton finished eighth, and Ocon finished 12th officially.
Right.
So, and it's if you look at the stats, it was Hamilton 50.4 seconds behind, Bottas 52.5, Vettel 53.5, Gasly 54.2, Ocon 55.6. So that 5-second penalty cost him four places, or three places at least. So, had Alonso been pushing from the beginning, instead of being 34 seconds behind Lando Norris, they would have been, what, maybe 5 seconds behind Lando Norris? And who knows how much more that group would have spread out.
Exactly. Yeah, that very, very strange Alpine and Alonso strategy there.
And Otmar had to know that. I mean, so someone had to, I think what you were getting at earlier, there was some, like, something personal going on in Alonso that he felt the need to do that for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, I get the impression he wasn't really helping his teammates. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. He wasn't helping his teammate, clearly.
Right. He doesn't have a contract for next year yet. And, you know, you've got Oscar Piastri on the sidelines, who's a very highly rated driver, looking for a berth. And, you know, maybe this is Alonso's just flexing his muscles, saying, you know, I'm really still a top line driver and much better than this other chap. So, and I'll demonstrate it by just ruining his race at Monaco.
Fascinating. Well, I am quite keen to jump into the Indianapolis 500. The jewel in the crown of the cup of the bowl here in America. So take that jewel in the crown at Monaco. And we had just another crazy, crazy race. So weather in Indiana during the race was in a lot of ways quite pleasant, but it was windy. And that caused a lot of single car incidents at the track. So a lot of people just lost their rear wing, you know, lost control of the rear, spun into the wall. That happened quite often for this Indy 500, but it was a lot of close racing. We had Ganassi looking really strong and Aero McLaren SP looking really strong. And Ganassi was Honda powered, and Aero McLaren is Chevrolet powered. So we had the engine suppliers were close. And we had different teams going. Penske was never really in the mix that much, at definitely at least for the second half of the race. And it was just another fantastic event.
It was, although it was windy, I mean, it looked like most of the drivers were coping with the conditions. I mean, there weren't too many incidents in the first third, were there?
Yes, no, it was on a relative scale kind of light for accidents. And when the accident happened, they were drivers on their own, as opposed to folks trying to occupy the same track at the same time. But it was also kind of a difference in strategy and calls and stuff like that. There was a late race yellow that happened, I don't know, maybe 10 laps before the checkered flag as Ericsson was leading. And pretty decisively, they switched to a red flag, got the cars in, leaned it up under a red flag so we could have a green flag finish. So it was kind of a nice little counterbalance to what we saw at Monaco, where there was just these layers and layers of decisions, one thing compounding and complicating another, and different circumstances. I'm not trying to say apples to apples here, but it was nice to see IndyCar make one good decisive decision that improved the quality of the race. And this was the end of the race we were talking about. One other thing I really want to mention is Scott Dixon, who's the six-time champion and also a Ganassi driver, was on pole position and led more than half the race. He was always at or near the front, save for, cycling through pit stops and just doing so well and looked really strong. And then for the final pit stop, locked up his brakes just a little bit, entering into the pits, speed lane violation in the pits by one mile an hour. Scott Dixon had to do a stop and go penalty within like the last 20 laps of the race. Livid, crushed. I mean, and you can imagine, you know exactly why. I mean, that was such a devastating result for him. He's been on pole for that race 5 times. He's won it once. So that was tough.
For a man of his experience to make that error, I mean, they have the speed limiters in IndyCar, right? So I guess he probably braked too late and just carried too much speed until the limiter kicked in. But that's a very strange mistake by Scott Dixon.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty simple, actually. He locked up and the car wobbled a little bit. So we had to get the car settled before he could just, get on the limiter and carry on. So apparently, before he was on the limiter cruising, he was going 51 miles an hour, not 50. Okay. So, yeah. But it was, at the end of the day, it was Marcus Ericsson, also in a Ganassi car, the first winner for Sweden in quite a long time. I believe it was Kenny Brack that did it last time around. And, Ericsson seems to be enjoying his time in America. But who finished second? The guy we were talking about earlier, Pato O'Ward. And Zach Brown was in Indy. Zach Brown was not at Monaco. He was in Indy and saw it happen himself.
But I want to talk, Robin, about the Indy 500 Rookie of the Year. Do you know who that was?
Jimmy Johnson.
And he crashed. So interesting decision to vote him as Rookie of the Year. I mean, he qualified well, didn't he? How was his pace during the race? Was it decent? Was he up at the front or?
He was okay. It was fine. He was, I believe he qualified like 11th or something.
He qualified 12th. So it was okay. A decent qualifying performance. But I don't, he wasn't at the sharp end, was he, before his shunt, I don't think, with a couple of laps to go.
That's right. That's exactly right. So,
I mean, there were a few rookies crashing. I know Callum Ilott crashed as well, right? And
that's right.
So maybe, as you were saying, the conditions were a little bit tricky. But I had when I saw that Jimmy qualified 12th, I had high hopes that he would be in the mix for a win, genuinely. So I'm a bit surprised he wasn't quite able to compete even on an oval, but because he was strong earlier.
I don't know, man. Fenders make a big difference. So. I'm just going to leave it at that. But we've got some great racing coming up in a couple of weeks' time. In about 10 days, we have Azerbaijan, which is always a good race, I think. But just in a few days' time, coming up is the Detroit Grand Prix, and that is for IndyCar and IMSA. I will be there. I will be doing a lot of stuff there. I'm going to be on the radio. I'm going to be doing stuff for my YouTube channel. Of course, I'll be recording interviews for this podcast as well. And I've already got a couple of interviews lined up. Hope to have a couple more in the near future. So that's going to be exciting, and we'll have a lot of coverage there. But, guys, that's just the appetizer, because I also made some new YouTube videos. I've got two to talk about. Both are kind of close to you in two very different ways, Chris. Lexus announced the fifth generation, the brand new Lexus RX. So I did a short video on that, kind of covering the basics of what this new generation car will be. Three of the four powertrains will be hybridized or electrified. None of them will have V6 power as the original did. And that's a nice little news story to get you up to speed on that. But I also did a video, a drive review of the Jaguar F-Type R, sir. 567 horsepower, 5-liter, supercharged V8. What a monster that thing is.
Man, I'm jealous. That is a dream car for me. What did you think? Thumbs up, thumbs down.
For the overall experience, huge thumbs up. When it comes to pure driving dynamics and, you know, just clarity of what you're feeling in your hands and your behind from the car, Porsches are ahead. But just the beauty of the car, the noise that it makes, the drive is thrilling. The limit's easy enough to feel. Ah, man, it's such a cool experience to be in that car. And that makes it a big thumbs up.
Were you able to take it out on a track, or was it all street roads?
It was all normal road driving. And, I mean, honestly, that thing weighs close to 4,200 pounds. I don't know how much track driving I'd really want to do in that.
Well, a bit of drifting would be fun, wouldn't it? Someone else's tires?
yes, absolutely. That's a good point. All right, I'll get it back.
Cool. That sounds like a great watch. I'll check that out.
Yeah, please do. And everyone else, watch it twice, maybe three times. But for now, I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. And Chris, I want to get some time on your plywood boat. Please, please invite me sometime soon.
Will do. Just when the plywood lake is, the conditions are good.
Very good. I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.